Well, hello, all you beautiful regenerative agriculture fans. Today, we're speaking with Austin Frerich. He's the author of a best-selling book entitled Barrens: Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. He's a seventh-generation Iowan, an expert on agriculture and antitrust policy, and a very diligent researcher. He's worked at the Open Markets Institute, the Department of Treasury, the Library of Congress, and now is a fellow at Yale University. He speaks truth to power in this book and pulls back the curtain on what's happening in our food system, calling out that power and corruption by name. Austin notes something that he feels, that I've heard so many others say, that we all know something isn't right in our food system. It's really expensive to eat healthy today, and farmers can't even earn a living wage. Something's just not right. Well, he lays it all out in clear chapters, each dedicated to different modern robber barons, these titans of industry, peddling in extraction, motivated by greed, at the cost of our health, our soil, our communities, and animal welfare. His message is landing on people's hearts in all areas of society. And let me just say right now, I think we should keep an eye on this guy in years to come. I have a feeling that Austin is just getting started. I'm Judith Farrell Horvath, shepherdess and owner of Fairhill Farm in Lancaster, Ohio. I share stories of struggle and success from farmers, ranchers, and adjacent entrepreneurs because I believe an interconnected network of small regenerative farms is the key to a resilient food supply chain in the future, along with living soils and nutrient-dense, clean food for everyone available locally. It's up to us here today to ensure an earth that future generations deserve to inherit. If you like this podcast, please like, follow, and subscribe. It helps us to keep the content flowing and helps others to find us too. This episode is brought to you in part by FOOP, Organic Biosciences, Liquid Foliar Spray, Cloning Gel, and Inoculated Biochar. FOOP products are living bundles of plant health goodies, including micronutrients, macronutrients, beneficial bacteria, and 11 strains of mycorrhizae. Listeners can enjoy 10% off by using code REGEN. Visit www.thefoop.com, and don't forget code REGEN at checkout. And now, enjoy the interview. Well, hello, Austin, and a very big welcome. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me on, Judah.
Hi. So could you introduce yourself and give a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I grew up there, went to college at Grinnell in Iowa, went to grad school at University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've worked at the Library of Congress, the U.S. Department of Treasury, and an antitrust think tank called Open Markets. And now I'm based at Yale, and I just published my first book, Barrens: Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food System.
Yeah, and it seems to be making a big dent in the universe, I got to tell you, just in circles that I've been traveling in. It's really impressive. I'm going to hold up the book here because I was reading it even before we booked this. I was reading this, and I have just been absolutely enthralled by the stuff in it. It's fascinating to me how you go through these different barons and just talk about their respective empires. It's fascinating to me. But what really resonated with me was actually your conclusion. And I wish I had read it first. So can we do these things a little backwards, and can we start with the conclusion?
No.
I loved your conclusion. Could you just kind of riff on that a little bit about, you know, the bigger picture that you see and what you learn through this, and talk about the broader landscape, and then we can kind of drill into a couple things here?
Yeah, so let me back up. I'm curious, what did you love about the conclusion? What really stood out to you?
I loved how you tied in the social aspect of the effects of the extreme centralization of our food system. The socioeconomic effects, the quality of living in small towns, the social fabric, the social cohesion, and the shift of the culture and middle class in America, because food is something that touches everybody. And living in a small town myself, that was formerly, well, before I moved in here, it was almost completely agricultural. I can attest to seeing sort of this. I mean, I live in the Rust Belt in Ohio, so I can see a lot of, you know, dilapidated farm structures and things like that, and old buildings that used to be this and now they're a Family Dollar or something like that, and the hollowing out. And I love the way you tied it into policy, pride, like all the different things that you talked about in there. I just loved how you wove it all together into a nice digestible picture of our bigger issue, and then also the hopefulness that you had in it, where you said it doesn't have to be this way. We're aware of it. We can change it. And here's some specific ideas. And I loved it. So there it is.
No, I'm glad you said that, because I've worked on this book for 5 years, and I presented a version of it at Marble Seed, that regenerative agriculture conference in La Crosse, Wisconsin, this time last year. Mm-hmm. And what I love about public speaking is, this sounds weird, but I view it as almost stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm,
I'm
mm-hmm.
testing out my rhetoric. I'm reading my audience. And what I realized is, especially in this moment we're in, you can't just put darkness on people. They need that ray of hope. And like, what the system could be is what's going to inspire people. So part of that conclusion really was, I didn't want to write a whole book just complaining. It's just, here's where, to me, the book is, here's what the system is. Like, let's not be naive to it, but here's what it could be. Like, I want to inspire people at the end. But I'm glad you picked up the social, that whole social effect, you know, that kind of cultural thing, because during, during COVID, my husband and I really got into road trips. We have an old road atlas. I love driving scenic highways. It's like my favorite thing. And there's just something about, you drive two lane roads, we purposely avoid interstates, and you just spend time in a lot of rural communities, and you realize there's no new capital flowing in. The land's producing the most it's ever produced, but none of that wealth is staying here. And you just kind of see, I don't think people appreciate much of the, people talk about inequality in America, but no one really talks about regional inequality. So like, you go up to Columbus, you know, for every Columbus, there's a St. Louis, and different regions of America are thriving and certain ones aren't. And I wanted, and even when we talk about this, I feel like in national conversations, it tends to be very patronizing or classist, and there's not empathy. And so that was really much a goal of mine, is just trying to be respectful to people, understanding their pain, but also offering a positive vision.
You achieved that nicely, in my opinion, at least the way that it landed on me. I mean, you definitely are one to not stand around admiring the problem, but you also did a great job of laying it out, you know, so that people could understand. And I also love the context that you put around it. When it came to national policy stuff, you said that some of the environments that, how did you put it? I'm trying to remember exactly, but the environment that has created the ability for these barrens to rise is also an indicator of some of our societal ills, and it also contributes to our other problems further down the road. Like, that was so insightful, and it came out of left field, but it's completely applicable and it makes a lot of sense.
I just think, like, this is such a random thing, but like, who isn't happy after a really good meal? Whereas, like, you know, a lot of the food in America now, it's just not, we pay a lot for not good quality, and it just kind of leaves you feeling icky. You feel bad. And to me, it's like, fixing the food system to me will help take the temperature down in America.
That's interesting.
And I like that. I don't want to add more darkness to people right now. And I think what's interesting about this moment, and what's been kind of blowing my mind about this book, is how it's hitting a lot of different pockets of America. You have everything from like, yuppies that live on the East Coast, when they go abroad, they see how much better the food system is. Mm-hmm. It's like a cliche to say, I went to Italy, ate great food and lost weight. To, you know, cattle ranchers in the West just screaming for help because they're being squeezed. To, you know, a lot of first-time farmers in the Midwest trying to figure out how to, you know, run uphill. And so, and then even like on like a normal suburban mom who sees what the prices are in the grocery store and sees the quality she's getting, is just kind of mad about that. And so that, to me, as weird as it sounds, gives me hope, because it's usually when weird bedfellows get together in American history is when things actually get done.
Yeah, it is. It's difficult to help people see another way when they've grown up on crappy food because we've been eating poor quality food for so many decades. It becomes like a generational thing. My husband still loves the blue box Kraft mac and cheese because it's what he grew up with, and I'm like, oh gosh, like, but I didn't grow up on that, and so I feel like people who have grown up on that, they're almost at a disadvantage because if you've never experienced something better, how do you know? And since you're only exposed to those things that are crappy in your local grocery store, because that's all you've got, then you don't have, there's no point of reference to something else. And not everyone can afford, and most people can't afford to go to eat actual food in Italy and understand that it's not like what you get in an Italian restaurant here in America.
It's well, two things. I mean, the thing that I go back to your, Kraft mac and cheese
Yeah.
is people forget how much engineering goes into these products of addictive. I mean, like, I cannot just have one cheese it. But that said, you hit on a really important point about taste. Actually, when I was writing this book, I did a lot of taste testings with people. Bacon's an easy one to do. I can do normal
Oh.
industrial confinement bacon versus like a pasture hog, because you're just eating with the stomach of another animal, and it's just like a hog that ran around, did piggy things, is just going to taste better than a pig that stands still and eats corn all day in a metal shed. And the same to me, milk is another really good example of it, where you're drinking the breast milk of another animal, and inputs really matter. So a dairy cow where the farmer has intentionally cultivated different grasses for her to eat makes a far superior product than, an industrial dairy cow in New Mexico. It's like I would do little milk tastings, have people rank them. And it's one of those things I kind of compare to like a lobster boil in a pot. You cut a corner here, you cut a corner there, you don't realize it. But we've cut corners for decades now. And we've gotten so far removed from what these things used to taste like that it's so stark.
It really is. I do pasture raised heritage breed chickens for eggs. And when I would sell my eggs, I would be having, a meetup club or whatever. And people would kind of walk up and they hadn't placed an order and they said, "How much for your eggs?" I said, "$6 a dozen." "I can get them at Walmart for $2. That's too expensive." And I would say, "This is a different product." And they said, "An egg's an egg." I'm like, "No, it isn't. What do you mean?" I was like, "Here. I give them a half." I'd always bring in a couple half dozens. I give them six freebies. I'm like, side by side, prepare two the same. Tell me it's not a different egg. Nine times out of 10, those people are back 2 weeks later. It's a
I mean,
different
that's just
color. It's
good.
completely different. I'm like, thank you. I ruined eggs for you. And I would love everyone to have their current crappy food system ruined for them.
It's one of the way I think about it too, is that price is even misleading. Like, sure,
Yes.
pops $1, $2 a 2 liter, but you're gonna pay for it with your health. But I want to back up and really make the point, and I'm trying to make this my grain baron chapter, is everything we eat is subsidized. The question is to what degree. And right now, the system is heavily subsidizing the unhealthy stuff. So, like, most Americans are barely getting by. And so I understand the short-termism of, like, okay, let me get, Hawaiian punch is way cheaper than carrot juice, but that is by design. Like, we have made choices in our politics where now it takes money to be healthy in America.
It's shameful, and I agree. It absolutely is. Well, let's talk about your farm bills. You talked about two different farm bills, right? I know you based your farm bill like dialogue off of two different models. So we want to riff on that for a second?
Yeah, so like
Okay.
I, this is me as a writer. I hate when like sometimes writers over caveat everything. And like I spent years learning about the farm bill, and like the farm bill is every 5 to 7 years. But I really wanted to make choices for you as a reader, where like I decided here's a good farm bill and here's a bad one. And I really, to me, the original good one was that New Deal farm bill that came out of the Dust Bowl, where I think of it as like Goldilocks, where it tries to essentially produce just enough but not too much. So you can get subsidies, but they were tied to conservation. So you had to take land out of production because you have to find that sweet spot of production. And there's also caps on how much you could get, what have you. But then what happened is my grain baron's Cargill, and Cargill's the largest private company in America. They're bigger than the Koch brothers, but no, most people don't know who they are because they're not consumer facing. And Cargill hated the New Deal from the get-go because their goal is to process and move as much grain as possible. So any system that tries to limit grain production, it doesn't help the family's bottom line, which you would think they'd be kind of, if you're thinking more holistically as an American, you're like, oh, I want like a stable farm system. That way I have stable customer base. But no, it's this rampant greed. It's just, you want more, more, more. So over decades, they systematically attacked and assaulted the Farm Bill, basically corrupted it. To what I focus on is, I call the 1996 Farm Bill, I call the Wall Street Farm Bill.
Yeah.
We're now, yeah, it's designed to overproduce. It's only built for Wall Street. It's basically, the programs are designed to overproduce grains at the expense of everything else. So now there's no limits on some, like crop insurance has no limits. And even the term crop insurance is misleading, because like when most people hear it, they think like, oh, like rainy day. Like, no, that's just, it's insurance for low prices, where 60% of the premium is paid for by taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically incentivized to, you know, keep growing. You're taking the risk out of production. But, you know, that's to me is why you have the obesity crisis is rooted. It's a structural thing where, you know, we make, you know, Oreos way cheaper than carrots. And so that's what I really focus in on, are those two farm bills, because to me, they tell two very different ways of structuring a farm bill.
Talk about the intentional overproduction and what that results in.
So the whole thing, the system is just, it's every year it's designed to produce more corn and soybeans. So even if prices are low, people just keep doing more and more because of the way the system's designed. And so instead of, you know, when prices are low, instead of growing apples, the system just supports you. And so you get weird, dumb things like ethanol, where instead of growing less corn, we find new artificial ways to increase the demand of corn. To now, the largest use of corn now in America is ethanol, which is just, I mean, I don't even talk that much about ethanol in my book. I just say, at best, it's a wash for the climate. It's a junk idea. The Museum of Failure included it as an exhibit item.
I didn't know
it's
that.
it's just a farce. And it's, but what it does is it does a few things. First of all, it crowds out animals on pasture, which I don't think has been appreciated. Is you basically have seen the Corn Belt expand the Midwest. So a lot of land that's kind of, you know, marginal, better for grazing, is now in corn production. We see that in Iowa and Southern Iowa. It used to be cattle country. Now it's just more corn, corn, corn. And then also makes family farms more fragile, because what used to be, you know, robust, they used to have 5-6 crops, are now just one, you know, 1, 2, or 3. Because it's like a lot of the, you know, we put animals in confinements, we corporatize the production of meat and dairy. And so most farms are just doing grains now. And so if you're, you know, if you think of almost like a family farm, like a retirement portfolio, where you used to have different assets. So in case one cratered, you'd be fine. Mm-hmm. When you're really dependent on two income streams, if one craters, you know, you're very fragile, but you can go belly up in a heartbeat.
That's a really good point. And I have to agree. I have seen a lot of pastures, a lot of fields go from pasture to grain and corn, specifically soy and corn production through the years. Even my next door neighbor, like, she's only got a few acres in the front, and it used to be, you know, a field, and now it's in production. And I'm even seeing a difference in the quality of soil and the weeds and everything around it. And, you know, you see, environmentally speaking, you see a difference in those fields that have been in constant corn and soy production. See, even new like drain tubing put in, things like that.
Yeah.
It's oh my goodness.
I'm just even driving. I was driving Northern Iowa the other day and just seeing people are taking up fencing, and you don't notice it. And like, once you kind of look, you're like, oh, a lot of the fencing is gone now in fields. You know, it used to just be let your cattle run in the fall and eat leftover corn. They don't even bother doing that anymore because they don't usually have cattle. And the other thing too, that's been lost in this, is Cargill's a massive seller of animal feed for these confinements, but it used to be, you grow your own animal feed, but now, so, which is like such a weird current, I mean, the system used to push you to like, or encourage you to have your own feed for your pigs and all that. And now essentially you have to buy it from my grain baron.
The self-sufficiency and resilience and renewability of our local systems has been intentionally harvested for the benefit of these few companies. I mean, I know there's more than just these six barons. There's probably other barons, but you know, your Cargill chapter really laid it bare as far as the grain, and then your dairy baron tied in obviously with the Cargill, and then your slaughter baron just really cemented the ripple effect of what has happened to small livestock producers and, you know, meat producers here in this country. It was sad. I mean, I knew it was bad. I didn't know it was this bad, Austin.
No, trust me. Me too.
I'm sorry. I know you're trying to be a bright light in this.
No. But like, I know meatpacking. I didn't realize JBS, that's my slaughter and baron. I didn't realize they bribed away to monopoly status, because that news was dropped right before the 2020 election. So it's just, I didn't absorb it. And like the fact that they bribed over 1,800 politicians to become a monopoly. And by the way, they pled guilty. It's not like this is allegations or anything.
Right.
And we let them keep their monopoly status. It's just wild. Like that means there is no punishment.
How does that happen?
Secretary Vilsack.
Okay, so he used to be the secretary. Let's kind of set the reference point here for some people listening. Now, Vilsack used to be in your home state of Iowa. Could you talk a little bit about his background?
Yeah. Let me just start before we frame this conversation. Is when I read the slaughtering chapter, my anger is actually with Vilsack, not with the meat companies.
It comes through.
Okay.
A little bit. Not bad, but a little bit.
I think my New Deal Catholicism shows itself there. Because the meat companies, to me, they're just a bully. They're just a kid that's never faced a real consequence, so they keep pushing the envelope, where Vilsack to me is actually like the really nefarious, like the bad character there. Mm-hmm. So for Vilsack, for your listeners, is state senator from Mount Pleasant, Iowa, gets elected governor in an upset in 1998, ran for re-elect in 2002. And I talk about this in my hog chapter because one of the big issues in Iowa during his re-election campaign were the growth of these hog confinements. I mean, you think of your home is your everything in America, it's your wealth. And one of these manure factories goes up next to you, it just destroys that. And you had a real rebellion, and you had people crying out for help. And the way Iowa works, keep in mind, he voted for this as state senator to create the system, is only the governor of Iowa can stop the construction of these confinements. So
even
his
local
opponent,
communities can't, they can't like put up enough of a stink, and townships can't say no.
In 1996, Vilsack voted to strip them of local control. So
I read that, but that is still like, I can't imagine. Oh my gosh. All right. Continue. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No. I mean, it was.
Thank you for the clarifying that. Yeah.
Well, just even as we talk about Vilsack, mm-hmm. and I don't know, think of him as Harold Hill from The Music Man.
Okay.
I'll tell you what you want to hear, but his words means absolutely nothing.
Mm.
So his opponent in the 2002 governor's race in Iowa was Doug Gross, who was the head lobbyist for my hog baron. My hog farmer has his own lobbyist, which I think mm-hmm. find kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
And these confinements were a big issue in Iowa. Vilsack ran ads on them. He promised to do something. After he won, Vilsack oversaw the largest expansion of confinements in Iowa history. So not only his word not mean anything, he promised to help somewhat people and stab them in the back, which that is so detrimental to democracy. But also, like, I think what really angers me there is like people in my space love to put the blame at Secretary Nixon's agriculture secretary, Earl Butts.
Yeah.
But Earl Butts never pretended to be the friend or family farmer. He literally said, get big or get out. Vilsack is like, I want to help you, as he twists the knife in your back. So I use that. I talk about that in my hog chapter.
Mm-hmm.
He is then Secretary of Agriculture under Obama for two terms. Between administrations, he's an industrial dairy lobbyist making $1 million a year. And his job basically was, Canada has a family farm dairy management system, and his job was to gut it so we could dump our industrial cheese and ice cream on their markets because we produce too much. And so he comes back in under President Biden, and you know, he does this whole song and dance about consolidation, which the theme of my slaughtering chapter is, we're back in the era of the jungle. I mean, these companies are, JBS is the biggest meat company we've ever seen in the world. The markets are more concentrated than the jungle. We have children working in these consumers are being gouged at the store. Ranchers are screaming for help. Like, it's honestly, it's one of the best pinatas I've seen in recent American politics for a bipartisan reform. And Vilsack utterly fails to do anything. He doesn't deconcentrate the markets, which we did a century ago. Like, this isn't rocket science here. Instead, he takes $1 billion of taxpayer money, throws it at new startups, new market entrants, which, by the way, I've asked USDA, there is no example of this ever working where you give money to startups against a monopoly saying good luck. You know, you might as well light that money on fire, because most people expect these slaughterhouses to go broke. Tyson's will buy them for pennies on the dollar or whatever. But like, JBS is what I would argue the closest thing we have to a criminal organization in corporate America. They're not going to give you an ounce of market share. What naive world are they going to do that?
No.
But that way, Vilsack gets the press releases that he's doing something, but that way he's not really doing anything, so he can be a lobbyist again. And so, like, that's what really bothers me here. It's just like, it's that false hope that really breaks people. And like, especially in this moment, you're just wasting time. Like, get out, like, just go be a lobbyist. Why are you occupying a seat?
It seems like performance and administratively, he failed upwards to his own personal benefit, despite lying and lying and lying. Like, he hasn't been held to account. And what did you say? He oversaw the destruction of the pork industry in Iowa. And then as Secretary of Agriculture, he oversaw the destruction of our dairy industry.
That's one of my favorite sassy lines I kept in the book.
Okay. Well, it struck a chord with me. I love it.
No, because it's biting. Because, like, what bothered, but
it's
like,
true. He's
really, yeah, it's true. And like, what's really effective about him and Scary is he knows how to placate a lot of people in the reform movement. He'll give them a little grant. He'll tell them what they want to hear. And it's just like, he's just music manning you. You know, he doesn't, what he's doing is neutering you. And so a lot of people privately have told me they knew from the get-go. When you start talking about meat industry, his stuff won't do anything. But, you know, they're afraid to talk out. They don't want to be excluded. And you're like, people like him will never give you a seat at the table. You have to fight for it. Mm. And the thing about it is, what I realized, especially with the hog chapter, is you're not playing on a fair field. And you're running uphill. And industry wins is when they can run out the clock on you. So to me, I'm very much like, strike when the iron's hot and do something now. Like, people are struggling, and you're just, I mean, that's what you saw in the hog industry in Iowa. Is you kept people like Vilsack would say, let's study it, let's, you know, let's think about it, you know, I mean, let's do a tax credit. But structurally, they're not playing fairly. And until you address that issue, you're going to lose.
Well, I do know that the regulatory burden is borne proportionally much higher on small producers. Being a small producer myself, I mean, if I were to have an inspection of a slaughtering facility, the cost of having that one inspector there would be a huge slice of my pie, as opposed to one inspector sitting on site with this plant that's got a million animals a day running through. And you know that they're not looking at all those million animals, but then they're over my shoulders staring at me, and I'm paying, you know, a quarter of my daily revenue to have this inspector, you know, looking over my shoulder. It would be dumb for me to say, oh, sure, I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to take that grant, and I'm going to be successful because I'm opening up my own local abattoir. I mean, I admire people who are doing it. I know a couple who have done it, and good for them, but goodness.
Here's but two things. To your point right there, that's a classic monopoly move.
Yeah.
Is they capture the regulatory structure and they try to undermine reformers like you and other people like you. And I will say, I wish anyone doing these slaughterhouses the best of luck. I mean, here's the thing. This would have worked if it was done in conjunction with structural changes. If you were to address our market power, maybe break up a few of the meat companies, by doing that, you could allow a new system that you're cultivating to emerge. But these barons will not allow a new system to emerge. And so to me, it's like, that's the sadness I have here. It's just like, this is what a missed opportunity by a corrupt man.
It's so sad because they're not just competing. They're kicking the doors shut behind. They are blocking people from even getting onto the field through their influence.
And that's why to me, it's all about structures. Like, I had a conversation with the libertarian the other day, and it's like, this isn't a free market thing. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you could try to remove as much regulations as you can. but concentrated economic power will win at the end of the day. And so until you deal with that issue, you can't actually do the regulatory stuff.
Does Europe have this situation whipped? Do they have this figured out?
I don't know as much. I mean, that's actually like, that's like one of my little things I would love to do more on is go to see other countries' food systems, understand the regulatory systems. I do know, sorry for the bad grammar, that right before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, was America and Europe were clashing with their food systems, where Europe understands, you know, agriculture is second largest contributor to climate. We got to figure out what to do here. Whereas like America, you know, Bill Sack was very much like, we can have it all. We can still engage in this incredibly destructive model. And they were clashing, but the war in Ukraine kind of put that to aside. That said, I mean, you have in North America, like Mexico and Canada are both very much done with our system because they see how destructive it is. I mean, Mexico saying no to heavily subsidized Midwest corn, and Canada just like not having it with our industrial dairy system.
To me, it seems like it's on this path. We're just on this path of unsustainable practices. And the majority of Americans have not really woken up to what that means and what's happening to our environment. And there's this sort of feeling that it's ridiculous to think that agriculture is, you know, contributing to global climate change and things like that. But I used to be in that camp where I didn't believe that CO2 was a pollutant. And my current point of view is that even if you don't look at it as a pollutant, soil needs carbon in the structure in the soil in order to retain moisture. Because every 1% of organic matter that you add into soil enables that land to hold 20,000 gallons of water per acre. So you can absorb and hold an inch rainfall per hour with every percent of organic matter you have in there. Meanwhile, the tillage breaks it up, and the microbes go into overdrive in an oxygen-rich environment. And from satellite, you can see plumes of carbon dioxide coming off behind tillage. And so tillage is the problem through the gassing out, because that causes the degradation of the soil structure. And then when you lose, you know, the organic matter, meaning carbon, anything with carbon, then you start having other problems. You start having runoff, you start needing more fertilizer, you start needing, you lose soil stability, it becomes depleted and the whole deal. And worse environmental problems happen. You know, you have a big storm and now that manure lagoon does get washed out into the bay. You know, it like those rain events are not retained. You do not have the replenishment of those aquifers. You don't have that water cycle is interrupted. You start having desertification. And so, I mean, it's a much bigger, more complex thing than the layperson understands. And so short to ground is, yeah, agriculture is contributing to climate change, but not all agriculture. It's conventional tillage, and it's the conventional tillage of the high grain production with the animals in the metal sheds and the untreated manure lagoons and the lack of regulatory oversight in these things. And that's contributing to our bigger problems. I mean, how do you break? You wrote a book about it, yeah, but at a dinner meeting or in a couple short sentences, how do you convey this to people who just think it's, they don't grasp it, or they've seized upon a one sentence, or they think it's BS. I mean, how do you start the conversation with people to help them understand this big, complex, complicated, multi-layered issue?
I would say, I mean, that conversation has really shifted in the last few years, and that's really because of the grocery store prices. The conversation starts now. People, especially older Americans, clock. They know meat and dairy prices. I mean, most people judge grocery stores based on their meat and dairy cases.
Yeah.
And it's, I'd probably open the conversation with beef, because I think beef best shows of like, if there's one chart I could include in my book, it's what consumers pay for beef keeps going up and up, and what the rancher gets is flat. To me, that's just classic story of monopoly, of just, you know, capture the dollar. So for people, I would sit there and explain, oh, we're just backing their monopolies, which I actually think most people kind of like that's why I like that robber baron framework is I'm harkening to something we've done before. We've tackled this issue, but people get it. They just kind of know. They know the quality's not there. They know they're being gouged. They know there's just been enough too in the last few years in the media where people are seeing something going on. I think that what you're pointing out to me is it's going back to this whole Wall Street notion of farming and agriculture because it's so short-termism. To me, it's like watching Wile E. Coyote run off the cliff. Like there's not any, like they understand, like any, if you're doing your own farming, your own land, you know the long-term consequences of your practices on your soil. But like even in Iowa, most farmland is not, like most land is owned by non-Iowans now. And so there's that separation where like grandma, grandpa die, the kids put into a trust, they move to LA, they rent it out. And that renter is not going to treat the land the same as someone who owns it. And also these kids don't know anything about it. And also the way the farm bill is designed is sometimes you have to really push your land to keep, you know, push the land to, you know, break even. So, I mean, you can always tell in Iowa when I'm driving is when land's rented because they farm right up to the creek. So you just see the soil go right into the water. So that to me is the bigger thing here is it's pretty easy for me to talk with people about like the system being broken. But to me, the disconnect really here is just the Wall Street corporate control of the food system has really resulted in the short-termism thinking that's not allowing us to do more sustainable, better tasting, better for the environment, and better for farmers kind of practices.
Do you think that there really is, I mean, only 1.5% of the acres under agricultural production, whether it's ranching, meaning animals, or farming, meaning produce? Okay, I'm just going to kind of use those terms there. Only 1.5% of those acres under agricultural use are farmed regeneratively. Do you think that regenerative agriculture really is the answer to stopping these barrens?
I'm smiling because it's
naive.
No. It's one of those I got to be very conscious of what corporate power, Wall Street's really good at capturing language and making words that used to mean something hollow. To me, I don't want to. I think so much of the last few decades of food reform effort has bifurcated the food system. That whole making a better system for yuppie Americans. My goal is to make regenerative the norm. Is like speaking I don't want to grow. Yeah, I don't want to grow a new system. I don't want to make another premium product. Yeah. I want to make this the product every American eats.
Yes.
That's why in my conclusion, I focus a lot on procurement. Is putting a locally grown sustainable green pepper in a Dollar General will not change anything. Most of the people can't afford it based on the current incentive structure. But schools buy a lot of food. Colleges buy a lot of food. Getting those procurement contracts really helps provide stable incomes from family farmers. You're keeping your money locally. You're essentially helping cultivate a new system as we address the old system, kind of phase it out. It's good politics. I mean, suburban moms love this stuff. I mean, who doesn't want, I mean, because they see what their kids eat. Like,
oh yeah,
no one wants, it's like making a cafeteria worker being a profession again, you know, instead of doing just cooking frozen food for part-time work, why not treat this like a middle-class profession where you can make, you know, scratch cooking based on what the farmers are producing in that, you know, at that time of year. These are all choices we can make. And so that's my goal with regenerative is I don't want to despair what people are doing. I'm just very conflict. I see industry already co-opting and taking this language and kind of undermining it kind of way we've seen in the organic space. I personally am very conscious of, I have my own critiques of organic. USDA has really failed to police those words. So you have a lot of loosey-goosey things going on. Like if I go to Trader Joe's and I see organic juice from Turkey, I kind of know it's BS. Because like there's rampant organic fraud in Turkey. But that's the problem with like USDA failing to do the right thing is you're really undermining people doing it right. And then what happens is consumers start hearing these stories of like organic fraud and all that stuff. And then they don't trust the label. And then those people that are trying to do the right thing, you know, then you're undermining them. And so like that is like what I'm very conscious of is like I don't want to depend on USDA to do the right thing right now, given how broken it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why like I rather just how do we shift the whole system in this way?
Well, you'd mentioned moving some of the duties to FTC or something like that. I don't know that they're going to be much better.
So Federal Trade Commission is actually, if there's a, as much as I can critique Vilsack, to me, one of the best appointments is the young woman that runs the Federal Trade Commission. She's the one bringing all those anti-monopoly charges against big tech. She's the one that just stopped the Kroger-Albertson or put, you know, is challenging the Kroger-Albertson merger. And she was actually just in Iowa this weekend talking about the Koch brothers are trying to increase their nitrogen fertilizer holdings. And there's opposition to that. I'm a fan of just stripping USA for parts at this point, like you said, because I view by every metric, USA has failed. It's failed farmers. I mean, what consumers spend in the store, farmers get the least amount of that ever recorded in American history.
I think we're down to 13 cents on the dollar. Yeah.
It used to be up to 65% after the New Deal Farm Bill was enacted.
Wait, it was 65 cents? Those are the numbers that regenerative agriculture is. Those are exactly the numbers that they're reporting in places like, and I've never talked to these people, but like Singing Frog Farms in Sebastopol, California, and other regenerative agriculture places where it's all no-till, but it's all human labor. So it's much similar to, you know, decades ago. But it's those are different margins. Those are the margins that we have managed to recreate in regenerative agriculture, like intensive small acres, like selling $300,000 worth of produce off of 2 acres and things like that.
So think of that. Like if your margins were three times what they are now and what that does for your local community, not even three times, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can pay a living wage to your farm work year round, not just seasonally. You know, you don't have that, what did you call it? The Southern model of sharecropping. That was brilliant, by the way. It changes the whole makeup of the world of agriculture. And it makes, you know, you mentioned earlier that you have the kids who have inherited the land from their parents and they're like, sorry, I'm off to the city because I don't want to starve and struggle and live in this debt-based system. Let someone else be doing that. Rent the land and walk out. Someone else can fail. That's fine. I still own the asset. But it makes agriculture a possible living wage, you know, an actual, you know, path forward into employment for people who are looking for things to do in agriculture.
That's why I gotta be careful with the rhetoric. I talk about this once in a while. I mean, I view rural America as an extraction colony at this point. Is Wall Street just extracting all its wealth out of it?
It only lasts so long.
Yeah. And like, I mean, we know how these stories play out. I mean, it's at some point people don't have enough of it. But going back to USDA is never underestimate what I noticed in my time in DC is you starting to take away an agency's budget. They tend to find Jesus. So even threatening, but even like a few things here and there, like take away FTC oversees all the markets competition stuff in America, except for meatpacking. Take that away from it. Maybe take food stamps and put it under HHS instead of USDA. I mean, things like that where you just like, we keep having, I mean, Vilsack is not anything special. I mean, a lot of USDA secretaries are like him. And so it's, how do we kind of this USDA was created after the Civil War. I mean, that's a very different time. So I'm not opposed to thinking blue sky here.
What would it take, in your opinion, to start making meaningful change at the local level that hopefully spills up to, you know, state and then national?
I mean, locally at the local level is procurement. I mean, I can't say that enough because I'm a big believer in that notion of laboratories of democracy. Where you let a few states do it, figure it out, and then, you know, then you go national because you see how good it is. People really love it. I mean, a lot of famous things in America started that way. Unemployment insurance, you know, minimum wage laws, kindergarten. A few states do it, they figure it out. And so to me, the procurement is do it, but then also let people know, first of all, brag about your success when you do it. It's great copy. People love reading about it in the newspaper, but also let your local law, work with your local lawmakers to let them know, hey, here's the issues we face. We would love to do this large contract, but you know, there's this weird rule with, you know, USDA, tell your local congressman. I mean, this is just kind of know that there's not really a vision here. And so, you know, you have to, you're kind of figuring out as you go. And it's a little bit scary, but once you kind of know that, I find it empowering because it's like, okay, because USDA is not thinking that. And so if you don't do this kind of work, then no one else is.
That's interesting. So procurement, like you said, the procurement being the first piece. And then you also mentioned earlier going to schools or restaurants. So small producers going and approaching these other entities and saying, you know, hey, I want to provide all of your, I don't know, your turkey, you know, for the local school here. You think that that's a foothold? You think that that could actually start to move? I don't know.
Yeah.
Small producers can't produce it. We can't compete in price against cheap crap.
But that's the thing. That's the thing is you gotta, let me back up and first say, you're mm-hmm. having a few states already make school meals free. And that's been hugely successful.
Mm-hmm.
I'd build on that and like, let's improve the food quality. I mean, a lot of, it's a cliche in social media, essentially take pictures of the garbage we're feeding our kids. And you get what you pay for. A lot of people aren't happy that they see what their kids, I mean, Lunchables for kids.
I know.
But right now that's heavily subsidized, whereas like, you know, your chickens aren't. And so, yes, we do have to pay more in the short term. Long term, we can decide to subsidize a more regenerative food model. But I actually think it's good politics. It's on a lot of places to be like, yeah, we'll pay a little bit more, but we're going to have food from our own state. Food from farmers doing it right. And you can even do like a grant program. Senator Harkin of Iowa was a long time like hero of mine, and he was really good at, they called them pilot programs. He would put them in the farm bill where we'll just do it in a few little places, show that it's successful, get buy-in from people, and then you kind of start scaling it. So even if you do just in your state get a program where, you know, maybe a few schools double or triple their reimbursement rates for food meals, use that money to buy local, and then just see what like 9-day difference that is. You know, and like even like something simple as like people don't realize a lot of these school cafeterias are designed by corporations and entities not to do scratch cooking. They're designed for frozen food. So you have to rethink a lot of this stuff. I mean, that takes money. That takes new capital into these cafeterias. But I think having just a few proof of concepts can actually go really far here because it's also a positive thing. And as I said earlier, the positive is what people really crave right now.
I like that. I like that a lot.
It's also a good set piece for politicians. So politicians would love to come get a picture with kids, even a good meal. You know what I mean?
Like, that's true. That's true. You got to appeal to the politician's ego and their reelectability.
Yep. It's all theater. I mean, even like you can serve your kids rainforest beef or, you know, beef from your local regenerative family farms. And like, honestly, that's good politics because that's also like really, really good bipartisan politics.
I'm sure a lot of science and, you know, social studies or even, you know, different classes in the schools, it would be interesting for them to understand the bigger ramifications of choices that they make at the grocery store. Like it would assign some measure of social conscience and awareness in them at a young age, just to learn about this stuff.
I mean, that's one of the things people really love is just bringing back home economics. Just update it, you know, bring back that, like, eat, like I'm embarrassed to say, I didn't learn how to break down a chicken until 2 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. Like I grew up just buying, I love chicken thighs. And I would just buy, you know, and you're like, wait, it's so much cheaper and it's not that hard to break down a chicken.
Oh no, it's not. It's not at all. And a lot of people don't know one of the reasons that one of my friends went into pasture chicken and he got out of it is because people don't know what to do with a whole chicken. I'm like, well, I know what to do with a whole chicken. He's like, yeah, but you're raising your own. Everyone else, like, you know, they wanted done for them. They don't know how to do it.
And that's like, I mean, but also what's great about bringing back home economics stuff is you can incorporate lessons from other classes. I mean, some kids just need that hands-on learning and understanding that. And my big point here is we don't need to reinvent the wheel. It's just never forget how radical the system is we have now. A lot of what we're talking about is actually very traditional.
It is. What about the people who will say, oh, home ec is a step backwards. It's in the wrong direction. It's, I don't know.
You'll see
gender
some of that.
Roles, I mean, or something like that. I don't know.
But like it used to be, but you don't have to teach it that way. I mean, there's plenty of teachers out there doing it in a modern way. I mean,
yeah,
I had a fantastic one in high school. I remember we did a lot of cool random things that I still think about to this day. Like we made brownies with applesauce. I don't know why that sticks in my head, but it does. I don't know. It's there's lessons we can take from the past. We don't need to recreate the past, but there's some really good lessons. And there was a reason why we taught kids home economics.
Life skills. Get them started. Push them out into the world with a little bit to go on. Relying on Lunchables and Hot Pockets forever.
Yeah. Honestly, I have a feeling boys will like break down a chicken as much as girls. Like it's just some kids just like to do things with their hands and understanding that people learn different ways.
Yeah. Kinetic learning is a big deal. You know, when people are doing something, especially kids, like hyperactive ADHD kids. I got two of them and they wanted to do stuff with their hands. You know, they didn't want to sit and stare at a screen. They want to read a book. They wanted to be like, they're busy, you know, doing something with their hands and doing stuff. Yeah, that's very true. So can we pivot for a second to you personally and the experience of writing this book? How long did it take you?
5 years. Okay. I mean, that's the curse and beauty of 5 years is you work on a little bit, you set it down, you do some thinking. It took me a while to really lock into the robber baron framework because the first few years I wrote it, I didn't have it. But I found the robber baron thing to be a really fun, interesting way to tell these bigger structural stories. So like the way my book is laid out is I actually, every chapter to me is about a structure. Like kind of like you noted earlier, is I'm building on structures. And then I just found the right rich person's story to tell you the bigger structures where like I joke, I have a whole list of B-side barons of like, you know, yeah, there's a potato baron, there's a carrot baron out there, but like, what point am I trying to make here? And also even doing this book tour where people tell me you should, oh, let me tell you about this baron. Let me tell you about this person, you know?
Oh my gosh. So you've got this whole list for volume 2, 3, 4, and 5, I guess if you wanted to.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know, but it consumes your life. I mean, even writing the chapters is, I mean, as your listeners know, every industry is different. And every production region is different. Like I have a very Midwest centric perspective and California food system is a whole different beast. So like Driscoll's is my berry baron. And I had to like, let alone learn California agriculture, but then I had to learn the berry industry, which is a beast of its own.
You know, it's these, all these barons, what do you have? You have got pork, dairy, coffee, beef, slaughter, grocery. We didn't even talk about the grocery barons. Being Walmart. Oh my goodness. That was mind blowing. That's where it all like comes together into like one big basket of, ugh. And then Vilsack and these really powerful people, and you're calling them all out. I mean, do you worry for your safety? I mean, maybe that's just my viewpoint. Does anyone brought this up with you?
I mean, my dad jokes to me that the mom's going to put like a dead pig head on our door, on his doorstep.
Yeah.
But I guess two things. One, as weird as this sounds, the more attention this book gets, I actually feel safer.
That makes sense. Actually, it does. That does.
Because, and also Eric Schlosser, so he wrote my foreword and he gave me advice. I mean, so Eric wrote that book, Fast Food Nation, 20 years ago. Yeah. That really kind of exposed that industry. And what he told me is industry used to attack you in the press, you know, and they realize they don't really do that anymore because it, whereas it sounds, it kind of helps you because it draws attention to your work.
Huh.
What they do is behind the scenes, they try to undermine you. So the dirty secret in the book world is you don't, you know, book, I mean, when you take something that takes 5 years, all this research money, all this time, you don't really make that much money on books. You make most of your money giving college talks.
Mm-hmm.
So what they try to do is get you canceled. Is they see you give a talk, they email behind the scenes, they flex their power. So they try to financially undermine you. And I've had that happen. I've had I'm looking because we framed, I did a tweet a few years ago where we got married in a small town in Iowa, and I was driving to the event doing that, wedding preparation stuff. And I noticed that the first multi-story confinement was going up in Iowa. Took a tweet, tweeted it, sorry, took a picture, tweeted it out, went a little viral. The Des Moines Register did a story. Anyways, a month later, someone at the Iowa Pork Association emailed my dean at Yale saying I needed a talking to. I didn't know what I was talking about, blah, 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 blah. The email was forwarded on to me, be like, don't worry about it. Here's the thing. If I was at a land grant in Iowa, I would not be employed and I would not know why.
Wow.
It's, but based on the tone of this email, this person has done it and done it to success before. And I mean, I framed this email because I kind of find it weirdly inspiring. But that's how power shows itself, is it stifles dissenting voices. So I don't know. I'm very much the sad thing about writing a book like this is you meet a lot of people that did the right thing and they failed, where you can only run uphill for so long, or they got stifled out. And it's a lot. It's a lot to hear people's calls for help that didn't go answered. People like Vilsack famously did these hearings in 2008 or 9 about concentration in American food markets. A lot of people stepped up, told in graphic detail how they were abused by corporations. He promised to help. He did nothing. Well, they faced consequences from these corporations. I don't know. I'm kind of the mindset, if not now, then when, given this moment in American politics, and also we don't have children. So I'd rather take my big gambles now before we do. And I don't know. It's Robert Barron's win is as long as the status quo is maintained. We don't talk about it. They win when you give up. And so
That's
I think
true.
also, I think the last part too is I think being front, like being an Iowan, I saw where we have the best farmland in the world, but it all kind of fell apart. And so I think there's a radical, it's done something to me personally where I just don't think people on the coast get what's happened. Because they see that illusion of the family farm and their pig, their pork package without realizing how destructive that model is for people here.
You also mentioned in your book that your mom used to have a bakery. And in many ways, the story of the factory farm out, just hollowing out these communities and putting these small farmers out of business, it's similar to what happened to your mom's bakery.
I'm glad you said that because that's something,
It's not
one of my
limited just to
beliefs.
farmers.
No, it's not. I mean, one of my core beliefs of this moment is we live in the era of quantification. Like everything should be a number on an Excel sheet. And first of all, that's just lazy. Not everything can be quantified, and to be a human being cannot be quantified. There's a relation. I mean, you could buy coffee anywhere in Iowa. It's not indigenous to Iowa. But people who came from mom's business because of the relationship she built with them, like the human connection. And I saw what happened after my mom, we closed the business, and she ended up working at Starbucks inside of Target for like a decade. And just how different that was, but also even how the company treated her, where every little thing you see on a shelf, Seattle tells her where to put. They don't trust her as a professional to know how to best serve her community. Like her store, for example, was mostly General Mills employees. So, they had certain taste preferences, certain things, but it was very much Seattle kind of stripped her of that professionalism. And I really want to make that point is people that own their own business, their own farm, whatever, they're just so much more care. They're just so much more holistic thinking. I mean, they're the ones that, finance nonprofits, donate to local things. These multinational corporations that aren't based in these communities or even based in this country just don't care. And we can't quantify that. I can't quantify care. Trust me, there's probably some people out there trying to do that, but in the day, you just kind of feel it. You feel it when you're in a local diner that's, locally owned versus going to Perkins. They're just different experiences. And I really wanted to make that point with my mom of this is what we lose with monopoly or consolidation is we lose a sense of humanity.
We do. We definitely do. Even when I go to places. And so I was just out in Las Vegas with my daughter a couple of months ago. And there was a lot of shopping, obviously. And in a lot of the places, it was just the same chains that I have at home. I'm like, come on, where's the local stuff? Where's that? I mean, sure, we're in Vegas, but, you know, we could go into a, you know, a Pink or, you know, a Sephora, you know, in Columbus, Ohio. We don't have to go to the Las Vegas version. So it just struck me as, even in the 20 years that I had been since I had gone to Vegas previous to that, I saw a difference. And this is Vegas. Like this doesn't even begin to compare to middle America stuff. I mean, this is like the crazy comparison, but it's real. You know, whenever I travel anywhere, I want to see the local flavor. And I definitely see the palate dumbing, whether it's from the local flavor in the food, or it's the palate dumbing of the local culture or the local stores or the local, you know, that's why people go to Europe, because they want to see, they want to go to that little conditorie in the corner in Germany where, you know, it's like eighth generation or something like that.
I'm so glad you said that, because that is something, local places maintain local culture.
Yeah.
And like my hometown is known for its kolaches, like these Czech pastries. Mm-hmm. I always had them for my birthdays growing up. That's what we did for, instead of having wedding cake at our weddings, we did kolaches.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, we found this, like, it was a local restaurant that made 600 kolaches. That's a lot of kolaches.
That's a lot of kolaches.
But like these national chains, they homogenize, and they also, these, you know, they're getting, they just, they don't preserve those local cultures, and they don't tell those local histories. And even to like an undercurrent to your Las Vegas example is the quality has just collapsed. I mean,
yeah,
I personally love going to estate sales, because I just think most quality, like you go to Walmart now and the quality is just garbage. You know, it's not, it designed so you to keep, so you buy a new one in a year, not so it's like you have it for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want you coming back. It's all about more. Mm. And I'm so glad you said that, because I mean, we're losing our local heritage with this homogenization from these systems, because as you see, you know, there's a phrase someone in grocery once told me, that big boys like to run with big boys.
Hmm.
And once you have one monopoly, it creates other monopolies, because they all try to, like, I mean, that's kind of the secret of Driscoll's, my berry baron, is they realized the Walmart of Walmart, they realized the rise of Walmart early on, where one company wants, you know, they want one company to do 4 berries for 4,000 stores year round.
Mm-hmm.
And so you create a berry monopoly. But when you create these supply chains, you make them very long, you make them very fragile, and you lose that localness, because they don't want to do, Walmart doesn't want to deal with one person, one company can only do one store. It's not efficient, or like they don't, it's not for them, it's like not worth the time. But it's that local company that usually makes the best stuff.
And they know the effect of their system on that population. You mentioned that Walmart knows how predatory they are to those companies that are their suppliers.
My single favorite example of Walmart, so for me, it's my favorite chapter. It's twice the length of any other chapter. It's,
yeah.
Walmart to me is the king of kings. Is they have this rule where if you supply to Walmart, no more than 30% of your sales can come from Walmart. Which I found this in a little business publication, Northwest Arkansas. And they even published a list shaming companies that are over that threshold. And they couldn't understand it. So I asked around to different grocery people I knew, and they told me, Austin, this is a supply chain risk management strategy on Walmart's behalf, where Walmart knows it's such a predatory, you know, vulture of a customer. You put yourself at bankruptcy risk if you go over 30%, because you basically, for most customers, you make money or it's a loss. It's either flat or you lose money on Walmart. So Walmart's logic is it wants you on life support, but doesn't want to kill you.
How does that get sustained, though? I mean, if I'm a producer and I know that I'm only breaking even with 30% of my stuff, that doesn't serve my business.
No, that's
why
what they
keep
want.
Selling to Walmart?
Because it's a lot of executives don't want to lose that sales. You don't want to lose a third of your sales. And but it's also, you said the word producer. These mm-hmm. people that are, if you're selling to Walmart, Walmart, you're not a producer at that point. You're usually a corporate executive because of like the volume you have to do. And no one wants to go back to their HQ being like, we just lost a third of our sales. And Walmart kind of knows that. And it really uses, it's, I compare with Walmart, it's supply and command. This is not a two-way street. This is not a negotiation. I actually really, when I first started thinking about this chapter, I thought of Walmart as the closest thing we've ever had in America to a Soviet Union style Politburo, where
those
Arkansas,
are heavy words.
They are, those are, but like when you move 1 in 3 groceries in America, your market share is the same as the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th grocery chain combined. We have never had that market power before in the food industry. And like, there's just all these little examples I show of where Walmart can sit there and basically dictate to people, we want this, we want you to do that. And it can just have profound changes on the American food economy in a way that I would say mirrors what Soviet Union used to have. And we know how fragile, when you have these very concentrated systems, they're just not, they're fragile. I can't say this enough. It's just, you see the second a wrench thrown into them, there's no fat in them. So they break, they snap really quick. I mean, we see that with baby formula. We saw that during COVID with the hog industry. We've seen it with IV formula, where a lot of it was made in Puerto Rico. And then when a hurricane hit, knocked off.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
I mean, that's the scary thing of this moment is when your food's, I mean, also just makes, going back to taste, it just makes a bad tasting food. When your berries coming from Morocco and not down the street, it just makes a bad product. That product is engineered for durability, not for taste.
Tomatoes. I like that. I hope you do write a Tomato Baron book.
That is like, but that's the funny thing about, living in the Midwest, leaving the Midwest, coming back, is people in the Midwest don't realize how good our tomatoes are. Like, I tried so hard to grow tomatoes when I lived on the East Coast, and they were just garbage. And like, you go to like any sub chain, you're like, this is not a tomato. Like, a good August tomato with bacon, a BLT, is like one of the best things out there.
Well, in New Jersey, I can say that they make some, they do grow some really good tomatoes in New Jersey. I grew up in New Jersey.
I'll have to try that. I mean,
if,
but like,
if you
can
get
them
local,
tomato,
try them. Yeah. Yeah. But rest of East Coast, I don't know. I'm pretty happy with the tomatoes here in Ohio. Definitely. But I know what you're saying, and it's absolutely true. We got to get those locally produced foods into people's hands. And I think that we need to be, we need to be creative. Joel Salatin says that, small producers should not feel guilty for, not being able to convert people. It is on, because they're working hard every day and they're doing their thing. But I'm butchering what he says, but the main thrust of the statement was, it's on consumers to demand this too. It's not just on producers to produce this way. Consumers need to understand that need exists, because that is what drives our food system, because people vote with their pocketbook, and it's hard for them to go out and find this stuff. But they have to do it. They must drive the change that they want, because only 2% of the population is actually farming. It's that other 98% that's producing.
And
it
I want
to
add
to
on
be consumer
to that.
Driven.
If you're a consumer that cares, you have the additional responsibility to help with the procurement. You can go to your local school district and say, I buy fantastic chickens from Judith. Please buy them. That is, to me, if you really care about this stuff and your eyes have been open, that's the best thing you can do. Besides, buying from the right, is help them grow their business, help stabilize their business. That to me is like the 98% of us that don't grow food. That is like our responsibility at this point.
Yeah, it is. So, your Barron's book has just been. I can't say that it was all new to me, like conceptually, like the stuff in the conclusion, again, like you, the way you all like wove it together, but the specifics on each, I mean, that was so much. I thought I was only halfway through the book and I was at the end and the rest is footnotes. I mean, good Lord, all of your research. I cannot believe how much research. I want to say, you did this in just 5 years? Lord.
Well, to be fair, if you're going to write a book on Robert Barron, you got to cross your T's and dot your I's. Like, that's been the funniest thing, is people have been really impressed with the citations. And it's like, no, you got to, I have 1,000 footnotes. And it's just one of those things where I mean, this is going back to consolidation, is in the book industry now, the liability, because of consolidation, it's shifted on me. So I didn't know that when I signed my contract. So if there's something wrong, I get sued.
Oh, I'm married lovely.
To a lawyer. Yeah, how lovely.
Southern model of book reading.
Oh, it's very much, Judith, the parallel. You have to hire your own fact checker. Like, people don't know that. When you buy a book, there's no guarantee it's been fact checked. I didn't know that. So first of all, I had to hire on my own money a fact checker. My fact checker found errors in other published books. But to my knowledge, there's only one mistake in the book. And it's almost funny where I opened my book talking about, I actually intentionally did this, where I wanted to open the book with someone fighting back against a robber baron. Julie Dunn of Iowa.
Yeah, yeah. In the pig chapter. Yeah.
So I identify her as living in, she lives in Eldora, Iowa, but I say El Dorado. So that, to my knowledge, is the only factual error in the book so far. But I think that's a funny mistake to make.
That is funny. El Dorado. The city of gold.
Yep. And so I had a fun, she laughed when I gave her a call, and I had to let her know, hey, when you see your name in print, there's a mistake. And she just laughed.
That's good. Well, I got to tell you, what an absolute pleasure it was to read this book. Do you have, are you seeing a lot of success? Have the barons been fighting back, but by systematic ignoring of you, cancellation of things?
We had one, my hog baron did write a letter to the op-ed in the Des Moines Register like 2 weekends ago, saying actually his manure is good for Iowa. It's good for solar water quality. It's just like a poorly written op-ed. What I find funny about him is he actually has his own spokesperson.
Of course.
And it's just like, oh, I know her writing style. She wrote it. We actually, my last book event I did recently was in his hometown of Iowa Falls. And I think this town, maybe 5,000-7,000 people. We got 50 people. Which, keep in mind, you do book talks in New York City, writers are happy if they get half that. So we had 50 people in a library. And I mean, it was one time in my book tour where I was a little afraid, you know, I'm going into the heart of the beast, but he doesn't have most of his empire is not there anymore. It's in the upper class suburb of Des Moines. His headquarters looks like a dentist clinic. But I was afraid, you know, maybe he'll send in some people, whatever. But literally the room was full of just people that live in the area and are just PO'd about what he's done to the water quality, to their community. And I mean, people come up to me afterwards and like, oh, you should know this. You should look here. Oh, I've heard this rumor. I mean, that is,
wow.
I kid you not, the best stuff in this book came from people telling me it's people who lived it. Even who work for these companies are just sick of what they're doing. It's that they just know it's morally wrong, but they need healthcare. They need a salary, but they're willing to say, they'll tell you where to look. And I encourage your listeners, if there's anything when you read my book think I missed or like a good detail, let me know. I would love to do a paperback and, you know, add on to it. So that'd be incredible.
That would be amazing. So are you reaching bestseller in a category status at this point?
Yep. I don't know, maybe number one in the food book on Amazon for like 4 or 5 weeks now.
Nice.
It is.
Congratulations.
It's these little bumps where like, Drudge Report, the day my book was published, I was on Drudge Report.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eric Schlosser just mentioned on Fresh Air the other day. So I saw like a spike. And it's actually, what's funny is it's selling really well in airports. Like business readers love to read it.
Neat. That's clever. That's an interesting niche. I don't know that I would have predicted. That's neat.
I wouldn't have predicted it either, but like I think a lot of people find like the milk industry is really interesting. Like it's really, this stuff is complicated. It really is. Like the best joke I heard is, only 5 Americans understand the dairy program in America and 4 of them are dead.
Oh no.
No, I know. It's a bad joke. But the point of that is the dairy program is incredibly complex and people want to know. Because I mean, everyone eats and a lot of people I like going to the grocery store, and I know a lot of other people do too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of us go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, any parting thoughts?
No, my last thought is just, focus on the positive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's what the system could be. And there's no vision right here for that. I don't know. Neither party has a vision. And so articulate it. I mean, my big thing is like, I want Iowa to be the Italy of North America, but you know, that's, I'm playing favorites. But I don't know. If you wallow in the darkness too much, it can be overwhelming. And I gravitate towards how do we copy and paste the people doing it right? Because that's what we need. Is I want to live in that America. I don't want to live in the current model we have now.
I really like that. So how can people support you and follow you?
Well, the single best thing you guys could do right now is buy my book. Because to be frank with you, I was told by people in the book industry, books like this don't sell. And so being stubborn that I am, I love proving people wrong.
Awesome.
So that's huge. And also it lets me, you know, I'd love to do paperback, but I need to have strong sales and like letting people know. I mean, word of mouth is honestly, it's like a farm business. The best way to get customer acquisition is just word of mouth. If you enjoy it, let people know, hey, this is really good. I think this is, even like the kind words you said today, that really helps. I can't say that enough.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What you did was really good for everybody. And it's important that people understand what's going on, you know, behind the curtain, and you parted the curtains and you did a great job of breaking it down, telling some juicy tidbits and some sort of shocking truths, and then offering a path forward. And I think that's exactly what we need right now. I think you hit a home run. I think A+ on this paper, I'll tell you what, with all those citations and everything, all you did was mess up one town. And that was great.
No, I appreciate that. The nerd in me is like, that's like the little thing I didn't expect to get in the book reviews is everyone's noticed the citations. And I don't know, it's fun. It's like, you know, this is so stupid. When you read most books now, they don't include the numbers when you read.
Yeah.
I fought for those because I just feel like in this day and age, people want to know you have the receipts.
They do. In
they
this
do. They
age
want to
of
know.
Disinformation. Yes.
Especially these stats are scary to people. I mean, people are shocked. Mm-hmm. They're shocked to hear that some of this behavior is going on. And in fact, you'd be like, yes, here's a citation. Like here, you can go look up. And I even put the websites if you want to see for yourself how someone died inside of a, you know, hog confinement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that way you can know. And so I think people appreciate that. And it's been like a little, I've enjoyed it.
Wow. Home run. All right, Austin. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah. Thanks again for having me on.
Okay. It's gardening season. Throw away your Miracle-Gro. No need to buy 17 different products for growing all organic veggies this year. Try Foop. It's a revolutionary new plant food made with fish poop. It's Foop. But it's not even fair to call it plant food because it's so much more. It's in a category of its own. It's a spectrum of beneficial bacteria, 11 strains of mycorrhizae, fish manure, fish emulsion, seaweed, volcanic ash, which has azomite in it, minerals, and elements. Using Foop on your houseplants and garden is like a restock of all the micronutrients, macronutrients in the soil, plus a biological activity upgrade and repopulation at the same time. These products turn dirt into living soil. It's amazing. And they're certified organic. Comes in foliar spray, liquid cloning gel, and now an inoculated biochar, which is a total game changer if you ask me. Visit thefoop.com. That's www.thefoop.com. And use code REGEN at checkout for 10% off your entire order. That's code REGEN.